In 2002, director M. Night Shyamalan and star Mel Gibson gave the world a chilling rendition of an Earth invaded by extraterrestrials.
In 2021, we return to the Isle of Wales for a peated whiskey. That's not an isle. No, hold on. Wales isn't an island.
I mean,
the whole thing's on an island. Yeah, yeah. In 2021, we return to Wales for a peated whiskey.
The film is Signs.
The whiskey is Pendaren Celt.
And we'll review them both. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Bradley Paul G.
Yes, you are. Why don't you just give the people your social security number while you're at it?
Oh, yeah, man.
Full name.
I'm all about it.
How are you doing today, man?
Bro, I am doing well. Did you just ever get hit by moments where you're like, holy crap, I love my kids?
Oh, like every day. Every single day.
Haley and I just had the best bath time in the world, and Sadie is just perfect. And
you're saying Sadie had the best bath time in the world.
Yes, yes.
Because what you said was you and Haley both just had the best bath time in the world, and that is a topic for a different podcast.
That's a Patreon only bonus episode.
Yeah, man, I hear you. We've taken a couple weeks off from recording for the podcast, and this is our first time kind of back in the saddle. It's been good to just take a little breather, enjoy life. I've been trick-or-treating for the last two nights before this, so my feet are a little tired from walking, but my gut is full of my children's candy. So, you know,
yeah,
it's a good day.
Yeah, dude, I went trick-or-treating. This is some news, actually. Hit the breaking news button. I went trick-or-treating for the first time in my life last night.
Ever, ever?
Ever, ever.
Were your parents, opposed to it?
It was in the 90s with, the people are putting needles in candy scare.
Okay. So it was less of it wasn't, a religious thing. It was...
Yeah, I don't think it was a religious thing. Huh. I know that there's a picture of me as a baby in a pumpkin costume, but other than that, I've never worn a costume for Halloween. I've never gone trick-or-treating.
Oh my
gosh. So this was it, man. And I snagged some candy for myself,
even though my baby
clearly would not be eating it.
I've got a couple observations to make. One is you've just not experienced life until you've gone trick-or-treating. But two, I've noticed that you've never been trick-or-treating by the way that you pronounce that. I put the emphasis on treat. You put the emphasis on trick.
Yeah, trick-or-treating. My only experience is with the movie Meet Me in St. Louis. And that Halloween experience was not about treats.
Did you throw flour in anyone's face and say, I hate you?
yeah. That's what I did. And I got really weird responses.
That's what we should do when people give us Tootsie Rolls instead of Skittles. Just anytime you get candy you don't like, you say, I hate you. Throw flour in their face.
Yeah, man.
We are wildly off base. Brad, where is this going?
I don't know, man.
Well, let me try to segue us.
This is a beautiful episode.
Perhaps instead of throwing flour in people's faces, we can throw cups of water in their face. Because today we are talking about M. Night Shyamalan's 2002 film, Signs.
See, what you have to ask yourself is, what kind of person are you? Are you the kind that sees signs, sees miracles? Or do you believe that people just get lucky? Is it possible? There are no coincidences.
Brad, as you know, and as most of our listeners know, this season we're doing something a little different. We have each picked a list of 15 movies to talk about that probably normally wouldn't get talked about on our show. These are not films that are generally considered classic, all-time classics. And this is the first movie that we're doing from my list. So let me just give a little bit of background on my history with this movie. I saw this movie when I was, 11 years old. I hadn't quite turned 12 yet. I went to the movie theater to see it with one of my cousins. I was so pumped. And this is one of those movies where You know, I don't know that I would really categorize this as a horror movie, because it's not overly scary, but it's like the perfect amount of scary for an 11-year-old. Like, I was, it was thrilling for me. And I walked out of that theater and I just fell in love with this movie. I told everybody about it. I was like, you got to go see Signs. I remember, like, you used to get the ads in the Sunday paper, and I knew when the DVD was going to come out, and I was looking at all the different stores, because this was in the day where, you know, once in a while when a movie would come out on DVD, the stores would have some sort of promotional thing to go with it to try to get you to come there and buy it. And I remember if you bought the DVD at Kmart, they gave you a Signs t-shirt to go with it. So I absolutely went to Kmart and bought this movie. I wore my Signs t-shirt all summer after that. It was freaking great, man.
What was it, a child size?
No,
t-shirt?
It was an adult XL. It was way too big.
So what I hear you saying is you're wearing that shirt right now to record this episode.
I really do wish I still had that shirt. That would be very nostalgic for me.
I'm sure it would be, man. Yeah, dude, I'll agree with you. As you were saying that this was you saw this for the first time in 2002, I guess, when it came out. Mm-hmm. I was like, this would be a perfect, like, 12 to 14-year-old sci-fi thriller to just keep you at the edge of your seat and terrify the bejesus out of you.
But you didn't see it until you were 30 years old. So I'm kind of interested to hear what you think. And I will say, just as a spoiler to our whole audience, I know just from our text back and forth that you did not watch this movie in one sitting, which kind of hurts me in the heart a little bit. I know life is busy for both of us right now, and sometimes you have to watch movies under less than ideal circumstances. But
during nap times, it's...
But especially for a movie like this, where I feel like the atmosphere that you put yourself in to watch the movie can really influence your enjoyment of it, I was a little bummed to hear that you had to stop halfway through.
Yeah, I mean, I made it... I think there was an hour left, so I was probably like 40 minutes into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I believe it's about an hour and 40-minute movie.
Yep.
So, yeah, I will say, Bob, for the first movie you've picked this season, it was not over 2 hours, and I was pretty pumped about
that. Yeah, man, it definitely wasn't. We need more hour and 40-minute movies, including credits. This movie was no longer than it needed to be. You're in, you're out, you're done. I watched it the other night after the kids went to bed, and I still got to bed at a reasonable hour. Like, it was pretty glorious, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, dude, the hour and 40-minute cinematic masterpieces need to come back. I mean, I even think back to last season. Like, Beauty and the Beast was our second-rated movie in the final bracket.
Yeah.
And that bad boy is an hour and 30 minutes.
Oh, tops. That's like, it's an hour and 30 minutes if you, like, take a pee break in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. You stop to like pop some popcorn.
All right. Well, Brad, I'm going to turn it over to you because it is time for Brad Explains. That's the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. I'm going to go ahead and assume this was your first time, right, Brad?
This was my absolute first time. And I was pretty pumped about it because, you know, you said earlier that the movies we've chosen this season aren't necessarily classics. I do feel like this is one of the most talked about movies on your side of the season 5 list.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it came out at a time when Shyamalan still had a ton of clout and kind of cultural, you know, what's the word? Cachet, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this was a big hit. Lots of people saw it. Apparently not you. So Brad, now that you have seen it, do you think you can break down the plot of this movie in 60 seconds or less?
I think there might be a chance of it, Bob. The movie Signs is about a former priest named Mel Gibson, and he and his brother Joaquin Phoenix are co-parenting Mel's two kids. Mel lost his wife in a car accident, which you find out later. She got snapped in half, bro. It was brutal.
Yeah, it was a rough one.
That was really rough. I was like, dang. But there's aliens and crop circles. And the story is just all about Mel trying to reconnect with his kids, trying to reconnect with his God. And you get to meet some aliens. And Joaquin Phoenix is really good with a baseball bat and water.
That was the most, like, esoteric. I feel like you just painted like a Jackson Pollock for us. You're just saying just random words. Stuff. You could have just thrown in like, you know, dolphins and dolphins. Cheeseburgers and just random words. Well, hopefully as we talk about the movie today, the plot will become a little more coherent for our listeners.
Here's the thing, though. I would say one of the strengths of this movie is that the whole plot... I mean, I know that a MacGuffin is like a specific item in the movie, but it feels like the aliens themselves are a MacGuffin for talking about the different signs that are going to lead Mel Gibson back to believe.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that's a great segue, Brad, because we kind of talked about this with The Sixth Sense as well. I actually went back and listened to our Sixth Sense episode a couple days ago to prepare for this one. And I think this is where Shyamalan was really kind of hitting his A game as a director with those three movies in a row, Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and this, is that he took a genre and he took an idea, which is like inherently a very scary idea. It's an alien invasion movie. But instead of making it really a movie about the alien invasion, it's a movie about somebody dealing with it, like incredible grief and trauma and an inability to forgive and cope, and asking like, all right, how does a family get over loss set against the backdrop of alien invasion? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not really about the aliens. It's the aliens are a plot device to get us to the end of the movie, which is Mel Gibson finding his faith again.
Yeah. I mean, if you wanted a movie about an alien invasion, go watch the pretty similar timeline to this. I think it was like 2004 or five. Go watch War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. Like, phenomenal movie. If you want to see a cool sci-fi action thriller, go watch that. If you want to watch a really deep, engaging drama with a sci-fi thriller as the backdrop, come watch Signs.
Yeah. Well, and I think, like, if I'm being honest, Brad, if I have to compare these movies apples to apples, this one and Sixth Sense, like, I don't know that this is as strong as The Sixth Sense. And, like, you know, both of the kids in this movie are really good, and they both went on to really long-lasting acting careers. But they're not Haley Joel Osment, which is the best child performance I've ever seen in my life. However, like, I also think that because Shyamalan isn't going into this movie thinking like, my goal is to scare the bejesus out of you, my goal is to make an alien movie, by using the aliens as kind of like the backdrop for what he's actually trying to say, I think it also kind of gives him an out when some things that he tries don't work. Do you know what I mean? Like, the aliens in this movie themselves, like, the design of the aliens, the reveal of what the aliens look like, are not really scary. Like, and I think that there's also a world where you could watch this movie and see that alien walk out at, like, the, whatever it is, like, the Mexican kid's birthday party, and just kind of laugh because it looks like a man in an alien suit. But I also think that at the end of the day, it's this kind of brilliant out that he's given himself, which is, hey, it's not really about the aliens anyway. It's about this other thing. And I think because of that, this movie really holds up. And I think it still works really, really well.
I will say, though, the aliens are not terrifying at all until the one is holding his son and that little jagged barb comes out of his palm.
Yeah, man.
Like where Spider-Man's web comes out. Like, that jagged thing comes out and you're just like, oh, snap, this thing's scary. Like, that's all it took for me to be like, oh, this is just a dude in an alien. Nope, that dude's scary. He's going to mess with, like, I was, like, expecting him to, like, stab it into the kid's nose. That was terrifying.
Well, and again, I think this is one of those things where, you know what, let's move into talking about the script. Because Shyamalan is writer and director here, and I'm sure we'll talk about him as director. But as writer, I think this is one of his stronger scripts. And, you know, it, like, in many of his movies, and again, we'll get into this when we talk about director, but some of the acting performances, which I think are all pretty much uniformly excellent, he kind of makes his characters do weird things, like things that normal people won't do.
Yes.
And I think it makes more sense reading it on the page than it does watching it actually acted out. But I think this is one of his stronger scripts in the way that it is put together, like the formatting of this script and the foreshadowing and the way that everything has a payoff. He put a lot of thought into this script.
Yeah, I'm with you that there's a lot of good payoffs. There's a lot of good moments throughout the script. But too often, I felt like Mel Gibson found himself stranded without the script helping him in any way. And it just felt like there were moments where... Do you remember when Frodo gets stabbed by Shelob and he kind of like, ugh! And then like the foam comes out of his mouth. I feel like Mel Gibson kind of had that look right before the foam comes out, like multiple times throughout this movie where he's just kind of like leering and like lurching around. And I just feel like there's a lot of moments where the script probably said, you know, look askew at the counter, or the knife, mm-hmm, or this or that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it just kind of left Mel hanging. And I think Mel did a great job in this movie. I really enjoyed him. Weirdly, it felt nice to just see Mel Gibson in a normal role.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it felt nice to see him just be a normal human being. But I don't know how I feel about the script on this one, Bob.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, some of the dialogue can be kind of cringy. I think some of the jokes don't pay themselves off very well. You can tell that Shyamalan was writing these jokes thinking, oh, this is going to be a nice little, you know, like break in the tension.
Right.
And then they happen and you're like, this is so awkward. Like, just cut this whole scene. I do want to talk about Gibson a little bit, though, because I think, you know, we're not supposed to talk about Mel Gibson anymore, I think, like as a society. I don't know. He's incredible in this movie. Like this might be his career best performance. He is just, I mean, like he's constantly on the verge of tears. And there were like multiple points in this movie where even when I didn't quite know what was going on in terms of what the script was setting up, you know, like the first time he has that interaction with Shyamalan's character, the vet who killed his wife with his truck. And he's talking about how he has an alien trapped in his pantry. And then the guy just kind of starts musing about like, hey, like, I'm really sorry I killed your wife. Right. And then they cut back to Mel Gibson and he is just like, you can see like the seething anger and resentment and unforgiveness. And also you can like see him wrestling with the fact that he knows it was an accident. He's angry about it. He can't really hold it against this guy. He's trying to forgive. His eyes well up with tears. Brad, there were like multiple moments in this movie where just the acting performances alone had me on the verge of tears.
Yeah. And then after that like beautiful emotional moment, Shyamalan himself, because he's the actor in that moment, goes, oh, and by the way, don't go in my pantry. There's an alien there. And then he drives away and you're like, what? Like, why would he say that in that moment? Why would he deliver it so deadpan? What, like?
See, I'm gonna start ending our conversations like that.
Yeah.
By the way, don't go in my pantry. There's an alien. Anytime you want to get out of a conversation that you don't want to be in anymore, just drop that nugget in there and slowly
and like
walk
make sure
away.
You're like looking perpendicular from them.
Oh man.
Dude, I'm with you though. I think Mel knocks it out of the park here. I think that when I think about Gibson's career, I really like him as an actor, but he always is playing something that's just so far over the top. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like when I think about him in What Women Want, he just goes over the top. This womanizing dude who's trying to get into the female brain. In Braveheart, he's, you know, he's freaking William Wallace and the overtopness works for the most part, but he's over the top. I just think over and over and over, that's kind of his MO. And this movie just shows that the dude has range.
Yeah.
Like he can play a small part, and not small in the fact that, you know, obviously he's the headliner for this movie, but small in presence.
Yeah,
like
it's very
himself
internal.
Restrained.
Yeah.
Internal. Yeah. And so those moments where he lets it out are amazing. Also, I think one of the best parts of this script, I'm going to give the script some credit. I think that the flashbacks to the night of the car accident are some of the best flashbacks I've ever seen in a movie. Like the way that they are used to advance Mel Gibson's character development in the present that the film is being filmed in, I was blown away by how each and every flashback very specifically spoke to who he is as a character. I really love the flashbacks.
So like, I don't know, what was it? 2-3 months ago now, he came out with his most recent movie. Shyamalan did. It was called Old. And Mm-hmm. Around that time, people, especially on Twitter, were just kind of going through the Shyamalan filmography again and talking about what's worked for him, what hasn't worked for him, because it's just, it's such a fascinating career arc. And I think the thing that everyone kind of agreed upon was, look, his writing can be uneven. His movies overall can be very uneven and up and down from film to film. He's one of the best directors of actors out there. It just seems like whenever he puts somebody in a movie, they give one of their best performances ever. And I think the obvious kind of analog for Mel Gibson here is Bruce Willis in Sixth Sense. And, you know, Bruce Willis was never like the I'm going to ride on a horse and shout freedom at people. He was always like the I'm really smarmy and I'm a wise ass, the diehard guy.
I would say he fits Quentin Tarantino movies in a way that Mel Gibson, I don't think ever.
That's
could.
Fair. And then you get him in Sixth Sense and he's really subdued and kind of sullen. And but he also is able to kind of telegraph that deep hurt that is going on inside of him. I think Gibson's even better in this movie than Bruce Willis was in Sixth Sense. And, you know, I mentioned the whole thing about Twitter because one of the clips that was circulating around at that time was someone clipped out the dinner scene in this movie where they all pick what they want to eat. And it seems like it's going to be like, hell, we're about to die. Like, let's pick whatever our last meal is. And then all of the like internal bitterness comes out during that dinner. And you finally see Mel Gibson just like break down in tears. And his son finally forgives him. And they have this big group hug. And oh my gosh, dude, that scene is so emotional.
Dude, when Richie Rich's older brother comes up and hugs him, it's the greatest thing in the world.
I think it's his younger brother.
Oh, younger?
Yeah, it's got to be younger because that kid's only like 12 in this movie. And
yeah.
Yeah, he's got to be like at least 10 or 15 years younger than Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, 10 or 15.
He was born in 89. That is a jump. He was born in 89.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, well, Mr. Younger Culkin, I thought was great in this movie. How did you feel about Rory's performance?
Oh, he was really good. And again, like this was one of those things where I thought to myself, all right, if you put Haley Joel Osment in this role, it's probably better, but you can't do that. That's like, you know, if you put Michael Jordan in the place of, you know, friggin' Zydrunas Ilgauskas on the Cavs, then they're a better team when LeBron's there the first time. Like, you know,
yeah,
but, what are you going to do?
Bob, you don't understand. That's completely different positions.
That's true. I probably shouldn't have brought up the like 7'2" Lithuanian center, but
whose jersey hangs in the Raptors.
He sure does.
Only because they wanted to get LeBron back.
And in similar fashion, Rory Culkin, his jersey is hanging in the rafters of Shyamalan children actors because he's really good. I think that some of the dialogue they give him is like eye-rollingly bad, and there's a bunch of exposition dumps that come courtesy of him. Like he's the one that's pointing out what happens in this book about invasions, and he's the one that knows what to do, or that, you know, that cracks the code of the baby monitor. And so I think a lot of the plot has to kind of come out of his mouth. But for it being as many exposition dumps as it is, I think he delivers it pretty well.
Yeah, I think for me, what really struck me was the way that he related to Abigail Breslin, that there's just something about sibling relationships that when they are done well on screen, I think that they can be one of the most compelling mm-hmm. like visions of humanity that you can get in movie. Is when you get young kids that just genuinely love and care for one another. So for me, it was really the way that he was protective and yet like encouraging and caring towards his younger sister that really made his performance stand out for me.
Well, and I think that that's a credit to Shyamalan, the director, again here, because from minute one, I was bought in that this was a real family. Like they don't, none of them really look anything alike, and yet I bought that they were real brother and sister. I bought that that was really their dad. I bought that that was really their uncle. Like, and it's kind of amazing when you step back and think about it because, you know, the age difference between Joaquin Phoenix and Mel Gibson, like it's never explained. And yet I don't care. Like, I think it really says something that you're not distracted by these four actors, because this really is a movie with four people and then a couple periphery people here and there. But they're in a house by themselves for most of this movie. And you absolutely believe in this family dynamic.
All right, so we've talked about them. I guess we can quickly hit on Abigail Breslin. I thought she was just great. She's a cute little kid. How did you feel about her?
Yeah, that's all she had to be, was a cute kid. You know what I mean? Like, yep. And I think we'll talk about this more in the second half, because I want to talk about what Shyamalan's doing here as a director. One of the brilliant things he does with this movie is that he doesn't show very much, whether it's the aliens or whether it's things like, you know, the weakest link in the acting, which is Abigail Breslin, because she's like 5 years old. You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to get out of her? And so when she's scared, they cut to a shot of her kind of panting and looking off screen, and then they cut to the next thing. And she's used very sparingly. She's really effective, and she does what she's supposed to do.
See, weakest link in the cast, I'm going to have to point towards Mr. Joaquin here.
What? Really?
There are certain moments in this movie where I really like him a lot, but then there's other moments where he just kind of gives me a massive stoner vibe that he's not really invested in any of this.
Well, I think that's his character, don't know, though. Man. Like, they go to great lengths, and I think it's some of the worst writing in the movie to establish, like, this guy's a fuck up. You know what I mean? Like, he could have been a big
army
deal.
Recruiting oh my office. Gosh.
What was with that scene?
Were they there?
Yeah, first of all, like, the guy who is the recruiter with his weird, like, Twilight Zone voice.
Yes.
What the hell was that? And then you have the worst monologue ever from this off-screen guy that's like, I'll tell you what he's doing here. Graham here is a grade A screw-up. And he goes on this long, uninterrupted monologue. And, like, the guy doesn't look convincing at all. He's got, like, a cut-off leather jacket or something. And I'm like, what? Who the hell is this? Like, that scene was horrible.
Yeah. And I think maybe that scene is, like, influencing me a little bit, but I struggle with Joaquin's performance throughout. I do like how he goes from being, like, the skeptic who's like, oh, that's stupid. They did that back in the 70s. And by the end of it, you know, he has the hat on with the kids.
That was a funny little visual punchline, though.
I was going to say, the jokes that he wrote into it didn't necessarily work. A few of the visual punchlines got me real good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When they walk in and he's sitting there with the kids, like that was beautiful. I don't know, man. What struck you for Joaquin? What made you like him so much?
I think that once you got a sense of who the character was, he's different than a lot of characters that Joaquin has played throughout his career. And, you know, you don't usually see him as like an athletic guy or a jock, but he was in this movie. For me, it was the scene where him and Mel Gibson are sitting on the couch at night watching TV, and they're talking about what is the meaning of this? Like, we see these lights over Mexico City, and it's mostly Gibson that's doing the heavy lifting in that scene, because he is the one that's breaking down. There's two types of people in the world. And just as an aside, I love me a good there's two types of people in the world. Anytime it's used in a movie, I'm like, hell yeah. Like, you know, Life of Pi, the end of Life of Pi, where he offers the two stories. It's the same thing here. He's like, do you see signs or are you a skeptic? And, you know, then you have Joaquin, who is kind of a more simple-minded person, saying like, I'm a science guy. And then he talks about that stupid, you know, I was making out with this girl at a party. And it's really endearing because you understand that, like, he's trying his best. And then Gibson comes right back and just kind of squashes it and says, like, my wife was cut in half by a truck. Like, there is no God watching over us. And you're like, well, like, he finally vocalized what everyone has been fearing the whole movie, which is that he's really lost his faith. And I think the two of them playing off each other, Joaquin Phoenix doesn't have a lot to do, but he's like lobbing it up for the slam dunk for Mel Gibson. Like, it's a really beautiful kind of alley-oop that he's giving him throughout the movie. And I think because of that, it's probably a more underrated performance than we might notice at face value.
This is completely an aside, but I watched North by Northwest today, and I just had missed this line before where Cary Grant asked the professor's name, and he goes, oh, I didn't catch your name. And the professor goes, well, that's because I didn't pitch it. And I'm just like, oh, man.
There it is.
That is a beautiful bit
baseball
of writing.
Baseball
jokes.
All right, man. I think this is a good spot for us to kind of hit pause. What do you say we try this Pendaren Celt?
Nah, dude.
All right, cool.
I'm over it.
Moving on.
Okay. Sweet. Let's get to it, man. I'm excited.
All All right. So today we are checking out Pendaren Celt. Now, Brad, I am just going to go ahead and assume that it's pronounced Celt because it's, you know, it's Celtic.
Yeah, like the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, I was going to say, here in America, I always have to second guess myself because you've got the Celtics, which is not a thing anywhere else in the world. But
It makes sense that the Boston, you know, the folks of Boston be like, eh, stick it to them, daggone UK people. We're calling them the Celtics.
It's just funny. Wouldn't you think that people in Boston would want to be like more accurate? They're all
right,
Irish.
With their,
like,
why with their Irish terminology.
I don't get it. Anyway,
we should just start calling them the Celtics.
We're going to call this whiskey Pendaren Celt. Now, if you've been listening for the last few weeks, Pendaren is a brand that we're featuring on the show. This is the last of the bottles that they sent us to sample, but they have many more varieties. They are a Welsh distillery, and they're kind of like the big player in the world of Welsh whiskey. And Brad, so far, so good, man. I'm really enjoying, you know, from the Portwood that we had last week to the one we had the first week, which I really was impressed by. This is a little bit different. You can kind of see it in the glass here, too. It doesn't have the coloring of those, wine-finished ones because it is more in the vein of a scotch and one that would not have artificial coloring added to it. This is their peated version, and I'm really excited, Brad. You know, we've been kind of up and down on peated whiskeys, at least I have, over the course of this podcast. And so to try this, you know, kind of softer profile with the peat added to it, I think is going to be a really interesting experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always down for a bit of peat. Doesn't mean I'm going to like it, but I'm always fascinated to try it. But for this one, as I jump in, the nose for me, it's really aromatic. There's some like nice fresh honeydew bit of a note that I'm getting. Some rosemary. It's fruity. It's a really pleasant nose, but I'm really working hard to get anything out of it. So I'll give it a 7.5.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 6.5. And partially because I was thinking about rounding it to a 7. So we're going to split the difference here. I think this is a very soft nose and it's really pleasant. But it's mild. And I think that's been kind of the overarching theme with Pendaren here. It's just, they're very nice, inoffensive, pleasant whiskeys. And they are like the first two that we drank, really, really good. When it comes to adding peat to it, though, I feel like you either need to commit or you need to not have the peat. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I'm not saying you have to be Laphroaig, where it's like offensive to me to put my nose near the glass. But this seems like it's just been kind of touched by peat, but like not you know what I mean, like it's just
touch like a point on the doll where they touch you kind of peat.
No, it's just like there's like a wisp of peat here, but it's kind of like, all right, well, it doesn't seem to be adding a lot, and in fact it almost seems to be like in conflict with what the rest of the nose is trying to do, which is, like you said, this more kind of like melon forward honey and floral thing. So I'll give it a 6.5. It's not bad. It's just, I can't tell where it's going from here.
Yeah. And as you get into the actual palate, it's kind of light, aromatic. There's like wispy notes of flower and fruit mixed with a little bit of saline. Really, I'll kind of spoil my finish score a little bit here too. I don't get much of the peat until the very end. And I almost wish, like you said, Bob, that there was a little more of it on the front of this. But overall, it's a very pleasant palate. I'll give it a 7 on the taste.
Yeah, my notes are almost exactly the same as yours. I put, this is more saline than I got on the nose. And then my next note was, wow, there's the peat. I thought that it was much more peat forward than I expected based on the nose. But the weird thing is, I feel like, you know, if the nose was 65-35 fruit and flowers against peat, it was like inverted here. It was like more peat than the rest of it. And I was kind of bummed because I feel like it just didn't strike that balance of that sweet honeyed melon thing and peat. It just seemed like we'll put the sweet honey melon on the nose and we'll put the peat on the palate and you're going to have to kind of piece it together yourself. So once again, I'll give it a 6.5 on the taste. On the finish, I'm with you, man. It's soft. It's pleasant. There's not much of a burn. There is a little bit of peatiness, that smokiness is left on the palate, but not in a way that's like offensive at all. It just kind of seems weak. I don't know, like it's not watery, but it just doesn't have any sort of punch to it. I don't know. Am I making sense?
No, 100%. It's a really soft whiskey from start to finish. For me, there's a little bit of mint that comes out on the finish that I enjoy, but it just kind of gets a little bit peaty. It leaves a bit of a saline flavor in your mouth a few minutes afterwards. It's a solid finish. I might be redundant here, but I'm just sticking with 7. It's just above average solid.
Yeah, and I'm going to do the same thing with balance. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. I think that overall, everything that's on the nose is on the palate, is on the finish, but it's never like in an equal amount. Like, it's always varying. Like, okay, on this part of the experience, the fruit's really going to come out. And then on this part of the experience, you're going to get almost no fruit, and we're really going to crank up the peat. And so it's all there. So it's fairly well balanced, but it just doesn't knock my socks off. I'm going to give it a 7.
For my balance, I'll give it a 7.5. For me, it doesn't kind of have the peaks and valleys that you're describing, Bob. It's well balanced throughout. It slowly moves from the sweet honeydew kind of spicy, not spicy. It kind of moves from the sweet honeydew mixed with baking spices into the peat really nicely. But there's nothing that really stands out in the whiskey to like kind of give it that punch that would knock it up to like an 8 or 9 out of 10 on balance. So it's just a 7.5 for me.
All right. And overall on the price, I think the place to set the price here, Brad, is at about $60, maybe a dollar or two more here or there. I don't know if this is sold in the state of Ohio, but what I'm seeing online is that this retails from somewhere between 60 and 65. Let's call it 60. I don't think this is a bad value for $60. I guess my question is more like, who's this for? Like, what's the market for this? Because
yeah,
the flavor profile of Pendarin is much softer than most scotches. It's closer to an Irish whiskey. It has that brightness that goes with it, but it also has that nice kind of honeyed floral thing that you get in like a Highland scotch. But then adding the peat here, it's like, it's not enough peat that's going to like appease people who really want peat. And I don't know if it's really going to appeal to people who want a really soft, delicate, drinkable UK whiskey either. So, like, I don't think it's priced extravagantly. I just don't know really who this is for. And I think that's really making me struggle to find a number to give this.
Yeah, for me, it's a 5.5. I think that there is just so many other whiskeys I would want to buy first in the $60 range that this isn't one I'd be reaching for right away. But it's not a bad value. Like you said, Bob, it's not overpriced. I think it's right where it needs to be. But there's just too many other whiskeys I'd want to buy for me to give this a really high score.
Yeah, I'm going to come out to a 7 out of 10 on value. Because again, I don't think it's priced at an incorrect point. It's just not really the first thing I would reach for, whether I was thinking of kind of a more delicate whiskey or a peated whiskey. And I think that's really where this kind of falls behind. So I'm coming out to a 34 out of 50. Brad, how about you?
34.5.
All right. Well, that's really easy. We're coming out to a 34.25 out of 50, or a 68.5 out of 100. I think I'd recommend trying this, Brad. I don't think I'd recommend buying a bottle unless this really sounds like something that's up your alley. Maybe if you're looking to first get into a peated whiskey, this might be a good place to start. But it's definitely pleasant, and it was a worthwhile drinking experience.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. If you're looking to get into the world of peat, this is a great place to start. So yeah, I would recommend buying it. I would even recommend maybe going in on a bottle with a friend. It's some good stuff. Honestly though, dude, Pendarin really just has a beautiful lineup of whiskeys that I am so thankful that we've gotten to try here.
I'll tell you what, I cannot thank them enough for sending us these bottles to try. They were super receptive to the idea. And honestly, Brad, I don't think they have a huge footprint yet in the States. But it's such a cool, unique market that they are offering right now. Like, how many Welsh whiskeys have you ever tried? For me, it was 0 before this brand. So
yeah. Also, the bottling is amazing. Yeah. I mean, they are some beautiful bottles.
All right. So there you have it. That's Pendarin Celt. Thank you again to the Pendarin Company for this. Brad, let's get back into talking about signs.
Let's get to it.
All right, that was Pendaren Celt. We are getting back into talking about M. Night Shyamalan's movie Signs, a movie that is still, Brad, near and dear to my heart. Like, I don't think it's a perfect movie. Push comes to shove, I don't think it's as good as Sixth Sense, but I'm probably still going to give this movie a pretty high score because at the end of the day, I still think it's really effective at what it's trying to do. And that's kind of, I think, how I want to evaluate movies is like, what's it trying to do? And is it successful at trying to do that? And on those terms, I think this movie works.
Yeah, I think one of the things we didn't really talk about in the first half of the episode was the cinematography. And I really kind of want to get into what Tak Fujimoto was doing here. There are so many shots that he just sets up beautifully. I think especially when the camera isn't moving, mm-hmm. or if it is, it's just like slightly zooming in or out. Mm-hmm. I think he just sets up a lot of beautiful shots. Some of them kind of remind me of Wes Anderson and how, what's the word I'm looking for?
Symmetrical.
They're like symmetrical. Yeah, Thank you. They're like symmetrical and synchronized. Specifically, I'm thinking about when they're at the pizza diner. And, you know, Mel sits down with his family to eat some pizza. And then you hear a car pull up and the shot is from outside looking in at them. Mm-hmm. And you just see like the perfect little square box framing the four of them. And then you see the shot of the person that's like getting into the car mm-hmm. and leaving. Mm-hmm. And it's M. Night Shyamalan, you know, his character who at that point, you don't know who he is. But, like, I don't know why that scene stuck with me so much, but I just thought it was so beautifully framed.
Yeah, I think this is a really great marriage of cinematographer and director. Because, go back to that scene. Like, it might sound obvious to break it down, but, like, what's the point of that shot you're talking about, Brad? Like, why cut to the outside looking in at them? And it's exactly what you said. It's to put them in the box together, right? It's a way of communicating, like, this family is on their own. They're boxed in. They feel alone in the world. Like it's conveying the emotion of what's actually happening with this family through visual language. And I think that sometimes Shyamalan, the writer, doesn't trust Shyamalan, the director, to convey things visually. And so he writes these really obvious scenes sometimes. But I think that's kind of why I want to praise Shyamalan, the director here, because there are so many moments like that in this movie where it's just, it's poetic, and it's just these really beautiful little touches that convey exactly what he wants to say without using any words. And I'm so glad you brought up that little scene and that shot in particular, Brad, because that's exactly what it's there for.
I also think that like the color palettes they use for this movie are great. There's something, and this is probably the Midwesterner in me, but there is something about a bright blue sky with a farmhouse and a little like barn behind it, and then rows and rows of beautiful green corn that just, oh, dude, it just stirs something inside of me, right?
Yeah.
And so when a director of a horror, you know, what could be considered a horror film, or at the very least, a sci-fi suspense horror film, is willing to bring you into those super bright, beautiful shots, that, dude, stuff like that is cool. Also, the moment where they are in their car and they're driving back from town and they give you like a perfect aerial satellite view of them driving.
It's so cool.
Dude, that is the moment of like, dude, the aliens are watching them right now.
Yeah.
Like we are in the eyes of the aliens.
Well, and it's such a cool contrast to the visual shot of the crop circles, right? Because the shapes mm-hmm. are completely different. It's like, you know, it's almost like a punchline or a joke because they're like, I wonder what they're trying to do by making these big circles. And then they cut to a shot of what the humans have done, which is just make a bunch of straight, you know, intersecting lines.
Yeah.
And it's like they're doing the same thing we're doing. It's a way of tipping the audience off to exactly what's going to happen later. So, yeah, you're right, man. And again, I want to go in on Shyamalan as director. And there's something I noticed probably, I don't know, 10, 12 minutes into the movie. And it's when I think it's Joaquin Phoenix is outside. One of them is outside and they hear the alien kind of like run into the cornfield. And it's Gibson, because then he grabs the flashlight and goes looking for it. But there's a little homage there. And I realized because of this little homage, I was like, oh, this movie is Shyamalan trying to make his Spielberg movie. even though the aliens in this movie are not friendly aliens like they were in E.T. or in Close Encounters, this movie is so heavily influenced by this 1970s and 1980s movies of Steven Spielberg. Everything from the fact that, like, it's not super violent. You don't see much of the creatures. There's little moments of humor. It's meant to be heartwarming. It's about a family. It's set in middle America. Like, everything about this movie is like, oh, this is a throwback to E.T. This is a throwback to Close Encounters. And I noticed it because the alien runs across the playset that they have set up for the kids. And there's a shot that pulls back through the playset and you see the swing swinging. And that's the exact same thing that they did in E.T. when Elliot first finds E.T. and he runs off and they showed the gate and the swings swinging after the fact. And it didn't tip me off. And I've seen this movie like 30 times. I watched it this time and I was like, oh, I totally get it now. And once you have it in mind that this is Shyamalan's Spielberg movie, I just, like, I sat back and I was like, yeah, dude, show me what you got. Because he, like, you can see the visual cues that stuck with Shyamalan as he was growing up, watching Spielberg kind of coming back and manifesting themselves in this movie. And at the end of the day, I kind of think that's why I enjoy this movie as much or maybe even more than Sixth Sense, because Sixth Sense is a better movie. But Signs is that kind of old school entertainment that I enjoy more. Does that make sense?
Oh, 100%, dude. And you're right. This movie has some pretty obvious comparisons to E.T. that I missed. And now that I'm thinking about it, like, the score of this movie has gone down at least a half a point, maybe a whole point. You're right, man. This is similar to E.T. and it's going to suffer because of it.
No, I do think, and you're talking about the score here, I think that the score of the movie is such a throwback to those John Williams Spielberg things too. And I just love, you know, when I clicked play on this movie, I forgot that it's a title sequence unto itself. There's just credits on a screen, and it's just this brilliant kind of overture from the symphony that's playing. And it, like, I don't know. I think that I love that this is unabashedly a movie that came out 25 years after the kind of movie it is trying to be. It's a throwback in every sense of the term, but it doesn't suffer because of that. Like, I still think it's super effective at what it tries to do.
Well, and it's super effective because it's trying to tell a story of a man who has lost his faith, struggling with coming back to it. And so, like, before we get into our final scores, I think for me, the best scene for me is a really short one in the middle of a scene that I didn't actually care for a ton. But when Mel Gibson is helping his son get through the asthma attack, and he just begins to just like quietly shout, like he's not shouting, but his words and his emotions are like shouting. Yeah. And he's just saying, I hate you. I hate you. Like, not again. And you can tell that he's talking to God in that moment. Like, the fact that he just told them, like, 20 minutes ago that, you know, there's going to be no prayer in this house. Yeah. And then he's praying to God his most honest, raw, real emotions. And that's, like, the breakthrough for him. That scene, man. That one got me.
Yeah, man. I feel like I'm getting emotional over here talking about it. Like, you know, as a person of faith, and you are too, like, we go through these times where we doubt, like, everything. And I think that Shyamalan is like, documented as being a person of faith. And it's really important to him. And I think this is one of the most honest portrayals of somebody going through that crisis of faith that I've seen. And I so appreciate this movie for that. And I think that what he does to set it up is even better, because at that dinner sequence we were talking about a little bit ago is when his son breaks down and says to his face, I hate you. Like, and it reveals his character's motivation, which is like, I blame my dad for my mom's death. And I think it's so telling that between those two characters, they very explicitly call out the person that they blame the most for that situation, right? Like, it is setting Rory Culkin telling Mel Gibson, I hate you. It's so shocking because it comes out of nowhere, because this family doesn't say things like that to each other. And for him to say, like, I hate you, it really kind of takes you aback. And then it sets up, you know, 15, 20 minutes later, Mel Gibson says to God, like, I hate you. And it's such a great setup for the eventual payoff, which is those people can't be reconciled to the person they're angry at until they like speak what is their most inner truth. You know what I mean? Like, Mel Gibson finally comes back around to his faith because, I mean, A, like, he sees God at work in what's happening there, but B, it's because he's able to confess, like, yes, this is what I'm thinking towards you, God. And it's the same thing with Rory Culkin's character. Like, he confesses to Mel Gibson, I hate you. And he knows he doesn't mean it. And he knows that, you know, it wasn't his fault that this happened, but they don't embrace and break down crying together until after he's able to finally say, like, I hate you and I blame you for my mom's death. So I think the way that Shyamalan, the writer, sets up those two moments, it's just such a brilliant little touch.
Well, Bob, I think we've said almost everything there is to say about Signs. I am curious, though, one last question before we get to our own final scores.
All right, let's hear it.
I was, you know, trolling through IMDb, as I do, checking out the movies that we watch. This movie only has a 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb. And, like, I won't often call out IMDb because usually I think that they're onto something. I'm amazed at that.
Yeah, man.
Like,
it's just so much better than that.
Yeah, I guess I'll give my final score. I'm going to give it an 8.5.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a solid movie. Like, it's like a B- to B movie. There's not much to complain about. The performances are stellar. So for me, I just don't know how it can't have at least a 7 out of 10 on IMDb. Yeah. What do you think it is that's keeping people from rating it more highly?
You know, I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the show or not, but I watched this video where the actor Seth Rogen was talking about how they wrote comedies in the late 2000s and why so many of those comedies are kind of dramas at their heart. And he talked about how he learned that a really good movie, it starts with a lot of plot and not that much story, like story being like what the movie's actually about. And by the end of the movie, you know, those two lines are supposed to go in opposite directions and they crisscross. And then by the end of the movie, there should be very little plot and the story has really come out and established itself, like what this movie's really about. And I think Shyamalan, especially in the early 2000s, was a victim of really bad marketing. You know, his next movie after this, The Village, is a pretty good movie that was totally mismarketed as a horror movie. And it's a straight drama with some supernatural elements to it. And I think this movie kind of suffered the same fate. Like, it's not that scary, but it's not supposed to be that scary. Like, you know, if you took the scariest scene at the beginning of E.T. and, you know, stretched it out to a movie length, that's what this is. Like, it's scary to an 11-year-old. But that's because that's not what the movie's about. The movie's about this family getting over this traumatic event and a guy finding his faith again. And I think because of that, Brad, I'll give my final score. I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. It's not a perfect movie. I think it's much more rewarding on rewatch because now you're not even going to be paying attention to the alien stuff anymore. It's like, it's kind of suspenseful. It's kind of scary. But the human elements of the movie, the dramatic parts, they are so much more rewarding the more you watch this movie. So that's where I'm coming out to, Brad. And I hope that kind of explains your answer a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where I'm kind of landing after listening to you for a second, it kind of feels like people who were looking for a Marvel Cinematic Universe type movie, like a horror movie where there's violence and action and things like that, I can understand why they would be disappointed. You know, in the end, this is a movie about some people who box themselves up and wait out an alien invasion. And I just wonder if the majority of people who have rated this on IMDb see it in that light, more so than what you said of it's a human drama.
All right. So we are coming out to an 8.75 out of 10, but we'd like to know what you think. So please find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Tell us what you think about the movie Signs. You can find us on all three of those sites at Film Whiskey.
Or you can join the conversation on our Discord. Guys, if you want to be involved with us the most regularly, you got to do it on Discord. It is super easy to download. You can have it on your phone, on your desktop, on your tablet, wherever you get the internet. Check us out on Discord. There is a link in the show notes. So go check that out.
All right. As you know, we have each picked a list of 15 movies this year or this season, and we have no order for them. So what we've been doing is putting each of these movies into a randomizer wheel, a spinner on the internet, and it's picking our movies for us. So I've got the remaining 14 movies from Brad's list in here. Brad, are you ready to find out what we're watching next week?
Dude, I'm like really pumped.
All right, here we go. Beep, 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 beep. Let's see. Ooh, a movie, Brad, that I have always wanted to see and never have. So this is two for two on movies Bob hasn't seen. 2005's Pride and Prejudice.
Wait, you've never seen it. Pride?
I've always wanted to. I just haven't gotten around to it. And now I will have to make time.
Oh, man. Carrie's going to be super pumped, I bet.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch it, man. All right, so join us next week for Pride and Prejudice. Until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.
Not an island. I don't know why that got me.
An archipelago.
Yeah, yeah. A peninsula.
I don't know what's the peninsula. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, you know. It's a bit of a. It's kind of like the Horn of Africa. I think they call it a horn.
Mm. Mm.
The horn of Britain.